Hi, and welcome to this latest episode of Security Nation, the podcast where we talk to interesting people doing cool things to advance security in some way. I am your host, Jen Ellis. I'm Rapid7's VP of Community and Public Affairs, and with me is our amazing co-host, the very finest Todd of the Beardsley. How are you doing, Mr. Beardsley?
Wow, it is definitely feeling like day three at RSA.
Oh, so, is it, boy?
I'm great, obviously.
Yes, peachy, just peach keen. It is actually a beautiful day in San Francisco, which is nice.
It is.
You know, global warming has that going for it, at least. Right. A topic for another episode. Is that not how this... boo. Okay, so maybe we should just move along quickly. So today we are joined by two of my favorite people. It's not going to sound like it because I am obviously going to tease them mercilessly. But two of my favorite people. So Josh Corman, who is founder of I Am The Cavalry, and Audra Hatch, who is also an active member of I Am The Cavalry. And maybe that's a really good starting point, is just to say, well, welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us, particularly after a week at RSA. Blah, blah, blah. But maybe you could start off by telling us a little bit about I Am The Cavalry and why that name.
I've heard of that.
You hopefully have, yes.
So we started almost 7 years ago at DEF CON in B-Sides, Las Vegas. And I kind of recognized that I was getting increasingly worried about our dependence on connected technology in areas affecting public safety and human life. And we were doing a pretty rubbish job at protecting credit cards and intellectual property. And I kept looking for the adults in government that were going to go fix it for us, and I couldn't find any. It's not that they're terrible. It's just no one was thinking about it or talking about it yet. So I kind of said to others, the cavalry isn't coming. No one's going to come save us. And when you realize that, you can either scream in the darkness and get depressed, or you can say, well, if no one's coming, what can I do? So we asked the hackers, will you be a voice of reason in technical literacy? Will you be a helping hand on issues where bits and bytes meet flesh and blood, so cars, medical devices, et cetera. So the idea was, let's be what's missing. And initially it was 50 people, and then 100, and I think at this point we stopped counting, but we think it's about 800 folks, initially hackers, now public policy makers and high trust relationships at FDA or in DHS or different things.
And it's all over the world as well, right? It's not just here.
Yeah, it's really exceed our expectations, but the goal was to try to accelerate preparedness.
You always exceed my expectations, largely because they're very low.
And one of the reasons it works so well is because we started with empathy and teamwork.
Oh, okay, yes, point well made, nicely done. That was a good rebuttal, I like it.
And we didn't just look for the most elite hacksaws, but we looked for the...
Oh, this is how I'm involved.
That's why you're involved.
Nice!
We looked for people that were complementary to our skills.
I'm so rarely complimentary, let's be honest. Cool. All joking aside, which is hard for me when I'm talking to people I genuinely like, unfortunately. I think Cavalry is a really cool thing. I think it's a great initiative. I am biased because I do participate. I think a lot of really good stuff has come out. Can you give us like a couple of like quick highlights, some examples of what's come out of the work?
Well, we initially started with automotive because there's only 20 car makers, and we figured that would be easier than 10,000 medical device makers. But it was actually the Food and Drug Administration that was our best and earliest teammate. And we've had a pretty profound impact on their pre-market guidance on the minimum requirements for medical devices, their post-market on how they do recalls. We helped affect the first safe and orderly recall of a medical device. It's purely for cybersecurity reasons before anybody got hurt. And I think those successes got Congress and others to pay more attention and ask other departments to work with us. And ultimately, the one I'm most proud of is that trust we built with the FDA got me on a congressional task force for healthcare to give a hacker's perspective, not just an industry perspective. And one of the top recommendations out of that was a software bill of materials idea that all medical devices should have a list of ingredients. And because Congress liked it so much, FDA is doing it. Now Commerce Department's trying to build on... I think we're going to talk about that, but they're trying to build on voluntary best practices for maybe adding transparency to the software we consume and build on.
It's super cool. I think, you know, we really want to get into that and hear more about that process. I just want to give a quick shout out to the team at the FDA who have been extraordinary in partnering with the security community and working on the stuff and sort of leading in a way that we haven't really seen from any of the other sector regulators yet. Hopefully they will. They will.
I often point to FDA as like the example of, you know, the kind of government organization that's doing it right, that came from a place of darkness and now are exemplary.
And we were told that FDA was part of the problem.
Yeah.
But I found Suzanne Schwartz specifically and her team incredibly brave.
Yeah.
And what we realized pretty early is they're hackers too, because it's really tough to make good, big changes in government, but they have absolutely found every possible way to maximize progress within their frame. And it's some of the most important team relationships in my entire life.
They've been extraordinary, and I mean, to the extent that they've come to the last several Vegas Hacker Summer Camp extravaganzas, they've been at RSA numerous times. They've really done everything they can to actively participate in the community. So big shout out to them, big props to them. And also, as we're about to move on to talking about the SBOM process, it would be remiss not to also give a big shout out to Alan Friedman at NTIA, who is leading the process. I think arguably one of the earliest of the Gubbies to sort of immerse himself in the security community, to be super present and active. He actually volunteers at a bunch of community events. And is an all round great guy, albeit very curly haired.
He's a real hoopy frood.
Yeah, that. Let's go with that. Sure. Absolutely. This is why we have you here. Thanks.
And a hell of a dancer.
Yes.
And the gold jacket says it all. Okay, so tell us about this NTIA process, and tell us about SBOM. You talked a little bit about why it matters. Can you build on that and expand a little bit, maybe?
Just so we don't skip it, the use case that was most compelling for government. The idea of a software bill of materials is not new. We're basically stealing from Toyota supply chains in the 40s. Deming introduced this to make the most profitable and high-quality cars in the world for 40 years. It's hard to look at manufacturing or chemicals without, or even food, without noticing your ingredients, where they come from. It's very foreign for software, but the example I used during the task force is about a week before we started our first meeting, Hollywood Presbyterian Hospital in California, in LA, shut down patient care for a week because they had a single Java deserialization flaw and a single JBoss library and a single technology, and it took out the whole hospital. And I said to myself, if an accident can take out a hospital, what could an adversary do? And we do have adversaries that want to take life. We do have Cyber Caliphate and Trek and Junaid Hussein. So I said, this is avoidable harm. You know, we're not going to stop everything with S-bombs, but the real key issue for them was they were warned SamSam was doing this, but they said, what's a JBoss? Do we have any? I have no idea, right? So we wanted a way to say, am I affected and where am I affected quickly? And it's a pretty simple thing to do to steal from proven practices in other industries. By the time the task force was done, as the ink was drying and was being read by Congress, WannaCry took out, you know, affected to varying levels, about 40% of the UK hospitals and trusts. And in London specifically, there were no trauma centers and stroke centers open. So it was pretty bad. If you had a stroke, you probably couldn't get care in the 3 to 4 hours you needed to without getting to somewhere pretty far from you. So that really motivated people in Congress. Congressional oversight was House Energy and Commerce. They said, we really like this idea. You can't defend what you do not know you have. They wrote a letter. HHS said, let's do it.
Ooh, props out to Jessica Wilkerson as well, since we've been loving on the Govies today.
Yeah, in fact, she was in House Oversight at that time, but now she's in FDA. so she can actually see this through. But when they had the mandate to go do it, FDA said, we're going to put this in pre-market. You can't bring a new medical device to market without having a list of ingredients. You should probably know what's in there. Hint, hint, it probably shouldn't be full of known vulnerabilities. But if there's a new one later, we can at least know quickly and tell the public. Well, Commerce saw that and said, whoa, wait a second. If FDA creates a standard, what if it becomes an accidental standard for everybody? Cloud software, mobile devices, IoT cameras. Let's take a multi-stakeholder approach and let's maybe see if we can make something that works for everybody. So in a voluntary capacity, NTIA did what they do, and they did multi-stakeholder and said to FDA, if we come up with a standard in time, will you use it? So you have this nice little pilot where FDA is going to mandate it for safety-critical regulated devices. They're willing to use the byproduct of these meetings, this multi-stakeholder thing. We've had four working groups in phase one, framing, use cases, standards and formats. And then the one that Audie and I were in was, we did the use cases. There's also been a healthcare proof of concept where I think it was 6 hospitals and 6 device manufacturers said, we'll make S-bombs for you. You can consume them. We'll see if there's any value. We'll see lessons learned. So instead of talking about this, we'll just go do it.
Well, and that's the important distinction, right, that you said a couple just a moment ago, is that, you know, these are not lists of known good software. We're not making promises that we're not shipping vulns. We're making promises that we're shipping software, right? And here's the list.
Yep.
Which is interesting because it's like it's easier, right? It's easier to mandate something like that. Like if you go down the path, which I know, you know, it has been talked about before, of like, oh well, let's just say we're not going to ship bugs. I mean, that clearly doesn't work.
This shouldn't be controversial. It's right. Controversial because it's not being done yet. Mm-hmm. But think about this: 10 years from now, or 15 years from now, we're going to look back and we're like, how did we ever not do it this way?
Sure,
right? We got to build.
It's like when we look back when like humans drove cars around. Like that was a crazy time. It was super dangerous, and tons of people died.
but you know, right now you have to do work to make these pretty soon. In fact, it's already happening in some ecosystems, but simply the act of making software will spit out an S-bomb as a byproduct in one of these standard formats or a plural. Mm-hmm. And it is not extra work to do. You just have evidence of what you put in that thing.
So you guys are co-chairs of a group.
We have shifted from phase 1 to phase 2. Yes.
Amazing. As we know, I'm big on awareness and adoption. It's my favorite.
Would you like to join our working group?
Ooh, gotcha. Wow. Journalism.
Not to put you on the spot or anything.
I am very interested, and I have contemplated joining the working group. I just also have a small time constraint challenge that means I'm trying not to overcommit. I mean, look, I'm recording podcast episodes all the time. How am I to fit anything else in?
Can we mark you down as consultant?
Yes. Oh my God, I love this. Let's use Racy. Perfect. Let's make things a little racy. Okay. So how's it going? How is the project going? Have you nailed it? Have you like, we totally know how we're going to drive adoption. It's done.
Well, phase 1 ended somewhat recently. So we published 4 documents, which you yourself could read at nta.gov/SBOM. So those are the fruits of the first 4 working groups. Ours is morphed. I think several of them have morphed, but ours is morphed from capturing use cases and best practices from the people that have been doing it to maybe localizing and translating these into the jargon and the nouns and verbs of different industries. So while we took a community of interest and we narrowed it towards these crystallized 4 documents, now we're in an expansion stage where we're saying, okay, if someone uses procurement language at a bank, well, when you're talking to the federal government, it's not called procurement, it's called acquisition, right?
So do you have people who represent those segments participating?
We have several new target demographics participating, but we have many gaps, so we're looking for introductions. We've enumerated the groups and industries we thought were most adjacent, the most popular conferences or trade associations or ISACs. And most of the first calls have been creating reusable materials like frequently asked questions, documents. We tried to create a golden PowerPoint deck, and we realized actually there won't be a single PowerPoint deck. If they're brand new, this is going to be why it matters and how to get started. If they're intermediate or maybe in the walk stage of Josh Corman bingo, crawl, walk, run, it's more about here's some things that you're going to run into, and they're worth fighting through, but here's the journey you're going to experience. And so I think we're pretty much in the stage of, for these new demographics, what do they need? And let's prioritize creating and packaging those things.
Awesome.
And in phase 1, we had 4 large deliverables. I know in phase 2 for each of the groups, we're targeting smaller deliverables, such as the frequently asked questions, 2-pager documents on how to get started. And after the recent webinar, we sort of shifted to asking the community, what do you not have yet, and what do you need from us? We have an idea of what we want to provide, but we do want feedback on what would be helpful.
What's the response to that look like?
It's only been a couple of weeks, and most, I think most folks are here at RSA. We've had a couple of conversations while here, so.
There's more to do before we have the results through. Okay, well, we look forward to hearing more about what those have.
And we're continuing to solicit feedback on that.
That's great. That's really helpful.
You know, it takes patience, too, because there were so many great problems tackled in phase one, and we have great answers and documents for them. But part of the outreach is they're asking brand new questions that are brand new to them, but well trodden for us. So we have to remind ourselves, okay, we did this a year ago, but they don't know that. So we are being the welcome wagon that's patiently saying, oh, that's a great question. In fact, if you look at this section of this document, you'll get your answer.
Okay.
I see some of our role as helping to funnel people into the right groups as well. So if you're a highly technical person, we'll get you into the standards
That's me.
Group. Or we've gotten a lot of questions this week about naming, and earlier in the week we talked about some of the challenges in trying to engage folks on helping to seek answers and solutions.
When you say naming, are people concerned with the term S-bomb.
No, not the term S-bomb, like the naming of software, unique identification of software. So naming and aliases and how software can... Alan has a couple of examples, com.sun.java, com.oracle.java, like what are you calling what you're putting into your S-bomb? I know from speaking with some of the other medical device manufacturers when they were creating their S-bombs for the phase one proof of concept, if they went down into further down into their dependencies, they could have included a package that was called something else by one of their third-party vendors. And so they had two versions of the same thing called something different. So for folks interested in those kinds of problems, trying to funnel those people to arts group.
It's interesting. I mean, there must be a lot of complexity that you're addressing with trying to find a way through this. And I expect that one of the priorities is actually trying to tackle that complexity and make it as simple as possible.
Yeah, I think some folks over-engineer it in the crawl, walk, run trio. Some of the banks that have been doing this for several years, when they buy software or hardware, they are told, they say, give us your SBOM. It could be a PDF, it could be a fax, it could be with or without hashes, it could be with or without versions, but they want to know, can you give one at all? When they started getting them in more consistent, if you couldn't, by the way, they would ask for a 20% discount because it's going to cost them more every time there's a flaw. And they were getting it. But later they said, okay, now that we're getting them in semi-consistent formats, they started looking at their most problematic software incidents, and they said, here's a list of not permitted technologies, and they would scrutinize that during the process. And if you have really, really old software parts in there that are high risk, they may ask you to commit to updating that within a certain time frame, or it might be harder to sell to them. So we think the act of transparency will allow people to make more informed free market choices. And if they don't care about hygiene, fine. If they care a lot, they can. And you know, even my own journey, I had to do product security. The first step is, I have no idea what's in that. And the second step is, holy crap, that's in that. And the third one is, I can get rid of most of that old stuff with minimal effort. And then the next step is, these ones are going to be really hard to fix. And so there's a journey going through that. But when you fast forward, you have much higher quality software with much less elective attack surface and elective vulnerability, with maybe fewer total projects, maybe higher quality, better performance in some cases. We got rid of tons of unnecessary code bloat. Mm-hmm. It's just, we didn't even know why it was in there. There was one software package we worked on that had like multiple versions of a very large package that weren't even being used.
Oh, wow.
People didn't even know why they were there. Yeah. And when it's we looked, it's like, we don't need it. Yeah. So that when it's been opaque, we've never had to care. It's going to be a bit disruptive as we start to do this. But eventually we're going to be in a better place.
One of the things that I've noted with this is the project's been going on for a year and a half, which is great commitment from NTIA to keep engaged. It's also great commitment from all the people participating to keep engaged that long. And it does seem like lots of people have stayed in it through the journey. What is the sort of vision of like how long it'll continue and where you'll get to, and you know, what are your goals on that front?
Well, the NTIA is a year and a half, but I think I've been doing this since 2013. The rest of the world.
You were doing it before it was cool? You're an S-bomb hipster?
Sure. wow. No, it was actually July of 2013. There was a Apache Struts 2 vulnerability, and a lot of banks got hit with it. And they realized, oh, I think the phrase I used was it's open season on open source because prior attacks were usually against bespoke code.
Sure.
But
I mean prior attacks like
in financial sector. But what happened is they went and systematically got rid of all their vulnerabilities in that particular code base, and they got re-attacked a couple weeks later because it was in their WebSphere, their Cisco routers, their Juniper. It was kind of everywhere, and that was when I realized this was a big problem. Jim Routh and the financial services ISAC realized it was a big problem. But then Heartbleed a couple months later is when the rest of the world realized it was a big problem because nobody knew which versions of OpenSSL they were using. If you might recall, it happened right before tax day, and IRS.gov didn't know if they used it, and you know, should we panic or not? So the journey's been longer there. I'm not trying to expand the scope too much, but I think for me, because my journey on this with the intensity has been on healthcare, I think FDA is very close to putting this into to action with the minimum viable inventory, as we would call it, and out of NTIA. So the NTIA may proceed, it may go along, but I think the real adoption is going to happen when FDA puts this into practice. They kick the tires, we make some mistakes, we iterate. They just announced yesterday that the new draft for pre-market guidance is coming out or just came out. So I think we're very close to enforcement for FDA. Yeah. And that's where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah.
So they're going to take a fork.
And it'll be, NTA. Like I say, like it'll be okay to like screw it up a little bit, right? Like, I mean, it's the first one, right? So it is the learning opportunity.
That's what the healthcare proof of concept is also for. Yes. And we just kicked off the second healthcare proof of concept 2.0 with a goal of, I believe our goal is to complete that by September. We're starting the process of selecting devices. We brought on additional medical device manufacturers, additional hospitals and other healthcare delivery organizations. And the goal since the beginning has been to iterate and to try this process, to test out what the framing group has indicated is the minimum viable for an SBOM. And so the 2.0 is designed to stress test that.
And she said this earlier, but we don't want these huge deliverables that take, you know, 9 months to make. We want lots of little ones. So I keep acting as if if they got hit by a meteor, we'd be okay.
Right.
they're not going to do this forever. I know Alan would love to be Mr. SBOM for the rest of his days. But and we're really looking at the mainstream adoption with NTIA. There are higher assurance use cases. I know the Pentagon and MITRE really, really want provenance and pedigree things. And if we have a good foundation, people can extend it. We're using SWID, SPDX, and even sometimes Cyclone DX. And there's some international standards groups looking to build on that too. And as long as FDA and the rest of us get that minimum viable, the extra stuff is gravy, and we can get smarter over time.
So for people who want to get involved, what should they do?
Call Alan, right?
On 555.
No. Here, let me share his personal cell phone.
Right.
I think the good starting point is nta.gov/SBOM. Those are the four really well-polished documents, and we each have weekly working group calls. Ours is on Fridays, 1 p.m. Eastern.
That website also has information where you can, it does have Alan's contact information where you can reach out and he'll sign you up or you can reach out to one of us.
And depending on your role, you might want to be working with, say, Art Mannion and his lovely mutton chops, lovely mutton chops. On the framing group, there's a standards group which has turned into more of tooling adoption because it's one thing to talk about what the output should look like. We now want every Jenkins, you know, package manager to spit these out. Revealed from the healthcare proof of concept 1.0, there's other adjacent tool chains that might want to get involved in tooling. Like a lot of these folks want to put those SBOMs into their inventory and asset management or their configuration management tools or their ServiceNow. So those vendors have put people in the groups now, and they're building on it. And I think that's the hard part for the hackers is we look at what's wrong with something, and we haven't stopped to say, if we had this, if we built this, how much better would IT be? How much more reliable would software be? So there's plenty of things missing. That's why we're building them, but there's a very motivated crew. In fact, I mentioned we started this journey in 2013. Some of the people who hated it the most were the really, really big software manufacturers that had a lot of technical debt. Now, on Monday, one of the presentations was from one of the biggest opponents to SBOM, they're doing it because out of their natural evolution, they get pinged so often by their customers. Do you have a flaw here? Do you have this here? And then they're finding that instead of fighting the software bill of materials, they're realizing this is the most efficient way to triage and deal with the increased market requirements to have this transparency. So people are coming around. We just have to be patiently impatient. And I think at this point, SBOMs are inevitable. And I can't wait to see what comes by use of their adoption.
Yeah, I think that evolution is great, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes. All right, so Josh and Audra, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes. Alan, thank you for joining us.
Yes, Alan, thank you for practically joining us. And thank you to everybody who's working on this. I think it is a great project. I think it's super important and will help us get to a higher degree of transparency and preparedness. So thank you for your efforts on this, particularly considering I have dodged and shirked. For some time.
But now you're a consultant. Mm-hmm.
Apparently so. Look at what happens.
We all heard it.
So I hope that you guys will come back sometime in the future and give us an update on where we are with it. When I say we, I mean you guys, obviously, because I'm just a consultant.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's so unsexy, but in other ways, I know it's going to have a huge impact on the safety and defensibility of our digital infrastructure.
Yeah.
You're talking about SBOM, not Todd, right? Because he's very sexy. Right. I just want to be clear. You'd only be half right.
I try not to state the obvious.
All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks so much. And enjoy the sunshine in San Francisco.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was a great chat with two of my favorite people, Josh and Audie. Thank you for coming on.
Hey, they're two of my favorite people, too.
Once again, we have traveled in time. Ooh, how do we do it? It's amazing. It's not. It's not amazing.
It's not. It's really straightforward, actually. It's just how time works.
It's not as amazing as UFOs. I knew I could get it in. Hooray!
Oh, God.
All right, fine.
We're not talking about UFOs. US Navy talking about UFOs on this podcast at all.
Just Google Pentagon UFOs. That makes it, I made it sound a little bit like the Pentagon created the UFOs. They were like, these are UFOs.
Not wrong.
Don't know what you mean. Okay, so what are we talking about in the rapid rundown today, Todd?
So this week I've got two things. I have good news and bad news. What do you want first?
I would like the good news first. Is the good news that the lockdown is over?
Negative, in a big way. No, lockdown is still in effect, except in Texas. Great. Sorry, everybody. But anyway, the good news is that there was this iPhone bug that got reported that was like a really big deal. It was... it's basically a no-click remote code execution exploit against the Mail app.
Wow.
And yeah, it's a big deal.
That does not sound like good news, unless your idea of good news is hacking people. Okay.
No. I'm building up to the good news. But this, like, as your reaction is correct, it is like, OMG, we should be dropping everything and dealing with this. There were indicators compromised. There was a lengthy post from the company that discovered this, ZecOps. With a Z. So it's like SecOps, but Z. So it's like even more American, I guess, when you replace S's with Z's, but maybe not in this way. but anyway, so ZecOps did this thing. Anyway, it turns out, not a bug. The follow-on reporting from Dan Gooden at Ars, Dan talked to Apple, who... Apple kind of famously doesn't confirm or deny bugs, and this is like also the case in here until like it kind of blew up and Apple said like, not a bug. It's a crash. Don't get me wrong. It's totally a crash. But there's a big difference between a crash and a security vulnerability. Crashes often, well, not even often, sometimes get you into a place to do code execution, but this is not one of those. It is merely a crash when you have a bunch of special conditions.
How do you mix those things up though? Like one of them is remote code execution and one of them is not.
Well, this is why. Oh, and I just wanted to say too, like the corroboration comes from this guy H.D. Moore, who also has looked at it and said like, this doesn't feel like a bug. So
he was like, and I know bugs,
right? And so that's kind of the thing, right? This is why in security research, when we find vulnerabilities, we prove it with a proof of concept. So the POC does in fact trigger a crash and it looks kind of funny, But the POC didn't go so far as to actually prove it. And the POC was never released publicly. It was just given to Apple.
Which is reasonable, to be fair.
It is very, very reasonable. What's not reasonable is
then doing a huge press cycle over it and being like, it's totally a thing.
Yep. Especially when it was like something like 2 days, 3 days after they told Apple. And Apple's like, we don't confirm or deny. And it's like, cool. Well, I guess we're telling everyone in the world. Like, you shouldn't, like, if you've been around the block, you know this is how Apple operates. And if you want to report bugs to Apple, that's great. And I really encourage you to do it. But also don't get too bent out of shape when Apple doesn't say anything for a little while. And like a little while being in the neighborhood of 60 to 80 hours. Like, you can wait a little longer than that. We like days, not hours. So anyway, so that's the story that I got really bent out of shape over this. And then saw the what amounted to a retraction. And it's also, by the way, not even a retraction. The folks at ZecOps are still kind of pushing that this is a vulnerability, but I don't know who's paying attention to them anymore. And I'm sure they're great and they're smart. And of course, they it's not easy to find crashes, even non-exploitable crashes. So good for them. And I'm sure they probably learned a thing or two about working with Apple.
So when you say you got bent out of shape, you mean on Attacker KB, right?
I do mean that. So we had just launched Attacker KB, which we talked about last week. I'm like, hey, this is a perfect bug for Attacker KB. I'm going to go in here and rant and rave about this. And then, you know, a day later, 2 days later, or whatever it was, I'm like, well, turns out that's not a bug. And so this is actually a really great way to exercise Attacker KB, because now I don't know how to, like, I don't know how to perfectly say, like, this bug was actually a hoax. Like, I don't have a hoax category here. So feature request, Attacker KB.
This does explain why, so Andrew, who we often give a shout out to, hi, Andrew, why he was giggling to himself about Attacker KB and your entry. He was reading it and he was like, oh, he's written about the iOS thing. And then he started giggling and he was very happy with things. So now I understand why. I'm guessing that you went on a bit of a tear and he found it entertaining. So, yeah.
I do. And like, I got accused on Attacker KB for trying to turn it into Reddit or something, which I'm really not, but I kind of am. Well, it's got the arrows on the side and it just really looks like Reddit. So of course I'm going to.
Were you like, how do I create subreddits? What's happening?
I know, but that's okay. Anyway, this is not about Attacker KB. It's so since you opted for the good news, you got the good news. No hair on fire iOS bug. Bad news. There is a hair on fire Sophos XG firewall bug. This bug is kind of a big deal, and we have it on the blog. If you just Google probably Rapid7 Sophos, you'll find it. We have pretty excellent SEO. Thanks, Patrick, our SEO guy.
Yeah, thanks, Patrick.
And so the deal is that Sophos... So first off, there is a patch available. You can go patch it. So if you run Sophos firewalls on your perimeter, please patch it, because it turns out auto patching, I don't believe, it does not appear to be enabled by default. You have to actually go turn it on, which is normal kind of for network gear. You don't usually want network gear just patching itself out from under you because it's critical. But that also means like now you're taking the responsibility to keep up on this kind of thing. So if you have Sophos XG firewalls in place on your edge, there is a pre-auth SQL injection vulnerability in the web app management interface for this thing on the internet side. And so apparently, and I have opinions about this.
What?
There is a web app management capability on the internet side of these firewalls, which is insane to me. Like, that's insane to me. Maybe that's how you want to do it, and that's why you bought Sophos. But it just seems very odd to have a whole web interface on the internet side. We talk about this like basically all the time. Anytime we talk about exposure, it's like, hey, and don't expose your web apps for your critical network gear to the internet. But this is by design in Sophos land, which is weird. But anyway, so pre-auth, SQL injection. So basically, bad guy can show up to your firewall and take control of your firewall. If that sounds bad, it's because it is
really bad. Yeah, that does sound quite bad. Is it just me, or have we, in the last couple of weeks, we've had like a spate of pretty bad vulns that have come out? Is that like, am I feeling that because we're all like, you know, working from home and sharing news stories more? And so I'm just hearing about it more.
that may be part of it, actually. It may be like a it may be like a perception bias because of exactly why you said. Also, by the way, we're doing this podcast twice as often.
Sure. But like, but I mean, it's not just the podcast, it's like conversations internally. So we had that Exchange vulnerability that if you haven't patched Exchange servers, please do so. And then we had the VMware one, right? And then the big hoopla around iOS, which ended up being overblown.
Nothing.
And
the giant pile of Zoom bugs that weren't. So here's the thing. Here's what I suspect is that not only are we all working from home, but tech journalists are also all working from home. And so they've got more time to find weird bugs lurking on the internet. Here's the secret. The internet has always been buggy. It barely works. And it is through the Herculean efforts of very talented people that make it work every day. There, I said it out loud.
You were not the first person to say it out loud.
No, I'm not the first person, but I've said it out loud. I am now the most recent. And now I'm not. Yeah. But anyway, but that's the thing. It's that like there's always been bugs like this. And if you want to go looking, you can find them. And maybe that's part of it is like we're just reporting. Like we're a lot more, I would say too, like as a culture, we're more dependent on the internet than ever. And like we're way more dependent today than we were 3 months ago. It's just like in our face constantly. And so like we actually care about these bugs more.
Oh my God, I legit didn't have internet earlier on today. And I really did think that the world had come to an end. I was just like, I was fine with lockdown. Now I'm hyperventilating. I was like, I can't, what will I do? What will happen?
Yeah, I often think of those poor people in 1918 who have like ball and cup, basically. That's their thing. Like, and some kinescopes that they might have around. It seems like 1918 pandemic is way worse than this one. Anyway.
Well, also, you know, also end of the war. Like, there was a lot going on.
Antibiotics, or the lack thereof. So anyway, that's my two for this week. iOS, no big deal. Sophos XG, big deal.
That was pretty great. I like it. Thank you. Yeah, and just as a reminder, patch your shit if you possibly can. And
all,
if you can't,
all of the time.
Take it offline.
ABP. Always be patching.
I like that, you weirdo. Uh-huh. All right, so it just leaves me to say a huge thank you to you for talking us through all this great stuff. A thank you again to our guests who were just here a moment ago in the attic with me, or in fact were at RSA several weeks ago. But thank you to Josh and Audie, and thank you as ever to our amazing, talented, and above all, incredibly patient and understanding producer, Bree. We love you, Bree.
Yeah, can't stress that.
I would tell you what to check out next episode, but I've got no idea what's going to happen.
No clue.
Check it out anyway. Hooray!